Good morning. Yes, everyone's awake. Good. So I have a question for us this morning. Have you ever struggled to try to take control of your world, but feel like your world ends up taking control of you? We're in the middle of a series entitled, Do You Want to Be Made Well? And in this series, we're looking at stories of where and how Jesus healed people and key questions that he asked them. Today, the question before us is this: what is controlling you? What is controlling you? Because there are things that seek to control us, and I probably don't even have to tell you this. Maybe some of you have been experiencing this. Maybe some of you feel this strongly. Maybe for some of you, you feel these unwanted forces trying to control you, and that could happen in your home, in your job, in your school, or even in your own head. But you know that there are times when it feels like there are these unwanted forces trying to control you. There was a powerful story that I recently heard on the podcast Invisibilia about one boy who struggled with being under the control of unwanted forces. In his autobiography, Ghost Boy, Martin Pistorius describes his experience of going through a rare condition called locked-in syndrome. And with locked-in syndrome, he was about 12 years old when he contracted a brain infection that caused him quickly to deteriorate both physically and mentally, and he ended up going into a coma. The doctors then gave his parents the sad news that the best thing that they could do is to take him home, to make him as comfortable as possible, and prepare for their son to pass away. And they told him that, and if he didn't, if he continued to live, he would just be in a permanent vegetative state, and at best he would have the intelligence of a three-month-old baby. And so later on, Martin described that time as becoming like a ghost, the faded memory of a boy they once knew. And so for years, Martin's parents, they took care of him. They fed him, they cleaned him, and they took care of him as best they could. But then something very unexpected happened. Martin began to wake up, or at least his consciousness did, but his body and his vocal cords remained powerless. And so Martin could see everything going on around him. He was fully aware of what was going on, but he couldn't tell anyone. He couldn't speak, he couldn't move, and he was completely aware of what was happening, but his whole life was then under the control of everyone else. Everyone else had decisions over his life, what he would eat and when he would eat, where he would go, when he would be rolled to his side or strapped into a wheelchair. And so Martin realized that he was going to be trapped in his body for the rest of his life with only his own thoughts for company. He later says that, imagine being unable to say, I am hungry, I am in pain, thank you, I love you. Imagine being trapped inside your body, a body that doesn't respond to commands, surrounded by people, yet utterly alone. Wishing you could reach out to connect, to comfort, to participate. For 13 long years, that was my reality. And he also describes the torture of sitting in the day room of a care facility watching endless hours of Barney. Yeah, happy, happy, nonstop Barney. And it made him miserable because here was this happy purple dinosaur and he was trapped in his own body, completely unhappy. He also describes other far worse pains that he endured at the hands of his so-called caretakers who completely failed to take care of him. And so during that time, he felt hopeless, and he even prayed for death. But then there was this day. There was this day that his dad took him out for a drive, and his dad stopped at a store and went in to buy something. And while Martin was sitting in the car, a total stranger walks by sees him in the car, and just smiles at Martin. And Martin says, I may never know why, but just that simple act of human connection, that fleeting moment of human connection, transformed how I was feeling and made me want to keep going. Eventually, Martin had a new aromatherapist who worked with him, and she came to believe that he was actually aware of what was going on. And so she convinced his parents to get him re-examined, and they did. And as a result, after about a year, he was able to communicate through a computer program that tracked his eye movements. And so eventually Martin was able to share his story with his family and with the world. And so with Martin, we have this amazingly unique firsthand experience of a person who is struggling with feeling locked inside his own body and under the control of unwanted forces. Today, we're going to look at a story of Jesus helping another boy who is trapped inside of himself. It's found in Mark chapter 9, if you want to turn there. And it says this, "When they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them and some scribes arguing with them. When the crowd saw him, Jesus, they were immediately overcome with awe, and they ran forward to greet him. He asked them, 'What are you arguing about with them?' Someone from the crowd answered him, 'Teacher, I've brought you my son. He has a spirit that makes him unable to speak. Whenever it seizes him, it dashes him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to cast it out, but they could not do so.'" So just before this scene, Jesus and three of his disciples, Peter, James, and John, were up on a mountain, and Jesus was transfigured in an experience with his Father. But then these four come down from the mountain, and they see the other nine disciples in the midst of a large crowd having an argument with these Jewish religious teachers. And while they're there, a man comes out of the crowd, and he explains to them what's going on. And he says that he has a son, and his son has some spirit that is controlling him and causes him to have seizures and hurt himself. And so apparently these nine disciples were trying to help that boy, but they couldn't do it. And they were being called out for it publicly. So then consider the various characters in this story. First, you had the nine disciples. Previously, Jesus had given power and authority to all of his disciples to go out and to heal the sick and even to cast out evil spirits. And so now these nine were trying to do good work, the kind of good work that Jesus called them to do, but they weren't able to do it. Have you ever had an experience like that? Have you ever had a time where you just were trying to follow Jesus, were trying to do what God was calling you to do, but it just wasn't working out, and you kind of felt like a failure? That was those nine disciples. And then another character, you have the father of the sick boy. I cannot imagine what he was going through. You have this father who sees his son constantly, day after day, hurting himself, suffering. And there's so little that this father can do for his son. He sees his son having seizures, which causes him to convulse, fall hard to the ground, foam at the mouth, and then freeze up and become rigid. And I know that there are people here in this room who have also shared that similar feeling of being powerless in seeing someone they love under the control of some unwanted force. And in addition then to these nine disciples and to the father, you have the boy, the key figure in this story. We don't know how long he was like this, but looking at the way it's described, this was not something new. He can't speak. He's locked up inside of himself with no way to tell the world what's going on. If you wanted to viciously control someone, just take away their ability, their power to speak, how maddening that must be for him to want to be able to talk but not be able to. I kind of wonder if his experience was something like Martin. being aware of what was happening, but unable to tell anyone about it. And so, in the details of the Father's description of the Son's suffering, he says a few very specific things. He says that his Son had seizures which dashed him to the ground. In the Greek, another way to translate this is he was tearing himself apart. And then it also says he gnashed his teeth. Another way to translate that Greek phrase is to let out a squeal, a desperate cry. Can you hear the desperation that this description conveys? Can you feel the emotion of that moment? And then the Son foams at the mouth and he becomes rigid. I know that today when we hear a description like this, our minds start to think, oh, that sounds a lot like epilepsy. Epilepsy, also known as a seizure disorder, is a specific neurological condition where the brain releases an abnormal electrical discharge, which can sometimes cause muscle spasms or loss of consciousness. And so as we're thinking of this in 2016 as some type of epilepsy, I want you to remember that in ancient Israel, their understanding of neurology was very different than ours today. And so the Father describes his Son's affliction in two different ways. We have this account in the Gospel of Mark, but there's a parallel account in the Gospel of Matthew. And in that account, the Father describes his Son with a word that essentially means lunatic. And he uses the word lunatic because there was a belief that the moon, which reoccurs in cycles, could have periodic control over people, causing them to act irrationally. And so for this father to see his son periodically have these seizures and act irrationally, maybe he thought his son was under the influence somehow of the moon in a way. Or in the Mark account, he says that his son has some spirit that is controlling him. In that time, these were the logical ways to make sense of what they were seeing. And so for that father, he might not have known exactly what the cause of his son's problem was. Maybe to him, he thought it was the moon. Maybe to him, he thought it was some spirit. But the thing he knew for certain is that his son was under the control of an unwanted force. And so just as that boy was being controlled by something other than his own will, we too might experience unwanted forces trying to control us, trying to govern our actions and our decisions. And so one of the first steps of being made well from the things that are controlling us is to identify the things that are controlling us. And there are four specific types of forces that I want us to think about: physical, emotional, social, and spiritual, because all of these types of forces could control us. So first, we'll look at physical. We can have physical issues that control us. So for you, what sort of physical or health things have been controlling you, have been affecting your day-to-day decisions? For some of you, maybe you've been dealing with health issues that affect your brain, your heart, maybe it's your nervous system, your immune system, or your insulin level. Maybe for some of you, you've been dealing with an addiction, and you feel in your body the power that it can have over you. And for you, with these physical forces, you know the daily calculations that you have to make if you want to stay safe and stable. You know the places that you don't go, and you know the foods that you don't eat. You know what it's like for something physical to have a measure of control over your life. And maybe for you, there's some emotional force that's impacting you. We can have these strong emotional forces that drive our behavior. So, for example, have you ever felt so emotionally overwhelmed that you all of a sudden found yourself doing something that you would never rationally plan on doing? For you, what emotions have the strongest sway over you? For some of you, maybe it's anxiety. Or for some of you, maybe it's fear. Maybe it's anger. Maybe it's grief. But all of these emotions can have a powerful effect over the way that we see others and even our tomorrows. We've learned to avoid the triggers and situations that are going to set us off. We know the topics of conversation that we avoid because we're just tired of letting these emotions run rampant within us. And we also all see in our society the way that fear and anger and grief can drive people to act irrationally. And so in addition to these physical and emotional forces, there are social forces at work. We can feel social forces acting on us like peer pressure, driving us to conform to what everyone else is doing. Maybe for some of you, you remember seeing the movie Dead Poets Society. But if you didn't, basically there's this scene where a teacher has a group of students, and one day he brings them outside and has these guys start to walk around in a circle. And as these guys are walking around, they're all going at a different pace. But very soon, they all start to sync up with one another, and they begin marching in unison. And once they do, the teacher pauses them and says, "Wait a minute, who told you to do that? Who told you to walk in unison?" And the answer was, no one. No one told them to do this. But in society, there are these unwritten and unspoken forces that almost compel us to act in a certain way. What social forces have been driving you? What even unspoken expectations have been driving your major life decisions? Because we all know the way that family, close friends, work environments, they can dictate our life decisions, our choices, and almost compel us to act in a way other than we want to. There are unwanted social forces that can easily drive us. And fourth, there are spiritual forces that can affect us and even control us. I will say that the topic of spiritual forces, for some people, it's totally familiar. You've been at church for a long time. You're comfortable with this sort of a language. But I know that there are also other people, when someone talks about spiritual forces or spiritual realities, it's a little uncomfortable. This is either a new topic or something that, again, in 2016, feels a little weird to talk about. So I think it's important to elaborate a little bit on what exactly the Bible means when it talks about spiritual realities and spiritual forces. For me, my experience of thinking about this topic began when I was in college. And when I was in college, that's when I first started to grow in my faith. I was reading the Bible, I was praying, I was getting excited about all these things, and I was a part of a Christian community that was wonderful, and I really loved being a part of it. But there were some people in that community who talked about things like angels, demons, spiritual warfare. And to be honest, it weirded me out. It felt a little extreme. I was uncomfortable with it, but I thought, I do see that in the Bible. This is at least worth looking at. So I started looking at it, and I started trying to think through what does the Bible say and what do I actually believe. And here's what I found. First and foremost, as I reflected on the topic, I realized that I do believe in God. Like, that was for certain. I believe in God. God exists. And how does God get described in the Bible? Well, in John chapter 4, it says that God is spirit, and he wants to be worshiped in spirit and in truth. Okay, so God is spirit. I got that. What does that mean? Well, it means that there is a dimension of existence that is other than just the physical and material dimension that we see of space and time. There is a spiritual dimension, a spiritual reality that exists, and God, in whom I believed, was spirit. But in addition to just God being spirit, I thought about myself for a bit, and I thought about my own inner life beyond just my emotions or my thoughts, and I realized that there was a part of me that was my spirit, my innermost me, the real me, and I know that this innermost me was made to be loved and to love others. It was made to experience wonder and hope, and that innermost me, my spirit, was created to be connected to the one who created me. And so if God exists as spirit, and an essential part of me exists as a spirit, then it wasn't all that far of a stretch to realize that there might be other spiritual realities that existed. And so if the existence then of spiritual beings that exist to do God's work, you know, to be an extension of God's work to do good in the world, felt more plausible, then it seemed that the idea of there being spiritual beings that look to do evil to try to oppose God's work in the world was also plausible. And so, in fact, the older I get, and the more I look at the world, and the more I see real evil in the world, this makes more sense to me. And we see it in the 24-hour news cycles, the newspapers, the TV, of the constant evil that we see in the world. It seems like there's something more going on than just the emotional or the physical or the social. It seems that there is some spiritual dimension at work shaping this world. And it's not to say that every bad action is driven by some evil spirit or there's a demon lurking behind every bad deed. But it's also to say that it seems like I can't explain all the evil in the world just by saying there are some bad people making bad decisions. And so if this idea of spiritual realities seems new to you, or it was a little uncomfortable for you, just at least consider if this paradigm of looking at the world and recognizing that there's a spiritual dimension to things might just help you make more sense of the world and what you see. So in the first half then of this story, what we see and what we try to do is identify what are those unwanted forces that are controlling us, because they're there, emotional, physical, spiritual, social, and they try to take us down a road we don't want to go. In the second half of the story, we're going to see the way that Jesus is able to free us from those forces. We'll see the way that Jesus makes us well from those controlling forces. Here's how the story continues. Jesus says, he answered them, "You faithless generation, how much longer must I be among you? How much longer must I put up with you?" Really hopeful words, right? Like you're feeling encouraged now. It gets encouraging soon. Hold on. But Jesus pauses for a moment. In words of just honesty, Jesus is honestly expressing something here when he talks about how that generation seemed faithless. In the parallel account in Matthew, he even describes them as being a faithless and perverse generation. And that word in Greek for perverse, it really means crooked or to be off on the wrong path. And for us, it's much easier to be controlled by unwanted forces when we don't have faith and when we're on a wrong path. And so if we want to find freedom from being controlled by unwanted forces, then the first step is this: get on the right path by having faith in Jesus. So what does it mean to have faith? Well, having faith means entrusting ourselves to someone or something. And frequently we think of faith in this religious, spiritual sense, but in reality, we practice faith all the time in completely non-religious ways. We can practice faith with our body, with where we're going in life, and with our futures in these completely non-religious ways. For example, we can place faith in our doctors. So if you're going in for surgery, think about this. You're entrusting your body, your entire well-being, into the hands of someone who's going to knock you out and cut you open and fiddle around with your insides, and we're okay with that. We know what it is to have faith in someone else with our bodies. And we can have faith in something like an airplane. Every time we put ourselves in a seat and we trust that machine and its crew to transport us from point A to point B, we are placing faith in that machine. Even if we have no idea of how that works or about the intricacies of aerodynamics, we can practice faith in that machine to move us to where we want to go. And we could even put faith in something as impersonal as a corporation. So if someone chooses to buy stock in a company, they're placing part of their financial well-being into the hands of some company, hoping that it will last into the future and produce some kind of a profit so you can get a return on your investment. We know what it's like to place part of our future into the hands of someone else. We practice faith all the time. What we're called to do here, if we want to be free from these controlling forces, is this: put our faith in Jesus Christ, because that's the safe place for our faith to be. Because we all know the dangers of misplaced faith. Whether it's a bad doctor, a bad plane, or a bad investment, we know the consequences of misplaced faith. And so let's see what happens next in this passage, because it's a beautiful description. Jesus says, "Bring him to me." And they brought the boy to him. When the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground, rolled about, foaming at the mouth. Jesus asked the father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. It has often cast him into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you were able to do anything, have pity on us and help us." Jesus said to him, "If you are able, all things can be done for the one who believes." Immediately the father of the child cried out, "I believe, help my unbelief." What is this man's initial faith like? Well, at first, he's not sure about this Jesus person. He's not sure what Jesus is able to do or willing to do. He's not sure if Jesus is merciful or powerful, but he's at least asking. And Jesus' response shows that Jesus is able to help, and Jesus does delight in showing mercy. And what we get from the story is this: the question is not of Jesus' power or of Jesus' character, it is of the man's faith. And so then the father says, "I believe, help my unbelief." I have to tell you, this is actually one of my favorite passages in the whole Bible. And I love it so much because I connect with it. And maybe it connects with you too, but so many of us have known that experience, that feeling where we believe and at the same time we don't. Part of us totally wants to believe in God, and part of us is holding back. Part of us is looking elsewhere. This man acknowledges that he does believe in Jesus, but he needs help with that. And maybe these words resonate with you as well. Because are there times for you when part of you really believes and at the same time part of you doesn't? Maybe you know that God exists, and maybe you believe that 2,000 years ago Jesus existed and taught and did things. But when you read other stuff in the Bible, or when you hear other Christians talk on the TV or on the internet, you think, "I don't know about all of that." If that's you, what are you supposed to do? Or maybe for some of you, you grew up believing, you went to a great church, and you remember these dynamic junior high Jesus Sunday school lessons, and they were amazing, and they shaped your faith. But then when you got a little older, you went off to college, you were taught by some really smart professors, and now you're rethinking everything. You're like, "Oh my gosh, I don't know if that junior high Jesus Sunday school lesson is going to work for me anymore. I'm learning physics and philosophy and biology. I don't know if I can accept this anymore." If that's you, what are you supposed to do? And maybe for some of you, you've been following this whole Christianity thing kind of on the outskirts. And for you, if you're honest, you're not really sure what you believe, but you at least know that you wouldn't fully identify yourself as a Christian. And so for you, maybe your relationship with Jesus is entirely non-committal, because it's all on your own terms, and you could still take it or leave it whenever you want. If that's you, what are you supposed to do? If any or all of these descriptions resonate with you, then here's your next step. Get to know the real Jesus. Get to know the real Jesus, not the Jesus that we hear in pop culture or that gets distorted in political rhetoric. get to know the Jesus of the Bible. And if you don't have a Bible, we have extras here that we just recently bought, so we can give it to you. You can take it home. You can keep it. You could read it. I'd even suggest read this book of Mark. It's the shortest of the four Gospels, and see what Jesus is like. Because when we get to see the real Jesus, it's going to be a lot easier to decide what to do with him. Because if you feel like you've had doubts about Jesus, if you feel like you've outgrown him, ask yourself if you've recently looked at what Jesus is really like. Because maybe you're not doubting the real Jesus. Maybe you're doubting your junior high perceptions of Jesus. For me, my understanding since junior high of math and physics has grown and changed a lot. I've been teaching it for 20 years now. The physics hasn't changed. The math hasn't changed. I've changed. My ability to understand things have changed. My perspective has changed. So for you, as you consider your eternity, it would be a shame if that was completely determined on some old junior high mentality. Get to know the real Jesus from the scriptures. And maybe for some of you also, you're struggling with faith, not because of Jesus, but because of someone who claimed to follow Jesus. And maybe you've brought into this room the baggage of being disappointed by what so-called followers of Jesus have done or have failed to do. If that's you, then I want you to take heart from the example of the man in this story. He was disappointed by those 9 disciples, but do you know what he did? He still went to Jesus, and he still reached out, even though he didn't fully get it, he went to Jesus. And when he did, as we'll soon see, he was not disappointed. Get to know the real Jesus, and when you do, you're going to see just how different he really is. As we've seen in this series, we've seen the tender way that Jesus cares for people. We've seen the way that Jesus is the face of love. We see that he delights in touching the social outcast, that Jesus delights in healing those with withered hands and those with withered hearts. Jesus sees us in our broken state, and he doesn't condemn us for being broken. He becomes broken with us and for us. We see that Jesus, even though he is the Lord, he came not to be served, but to serve. This is the real Jesus. And so if we're tired of being controlled by these unwanted forces, if we want to be made well, what should we do? We should believe in Jesus as Lord. In Greek, the word gospel is evangelion. And the word evangelion, it has a very specific historic context. People in those ancient times would use it as a way to herald, to proclaim, to announce the good news of a great new king or lord. And so here's how it would work. There might be a Roman herald who comes riding into town to proclaim with a loud voice, there is a new king, there is a new lord, and his name is Augustus Caesar, and he's going to do all of these wonderful things for us. That was the gospel proclamation. That's how people back then used the term gospel, the evangelion. Here's what made early Christians so scandalous in their day. They proclaimed a different gospel. They rode into town and they said, Jesus Christ is Lord and Caesar is not. For us today, struggling with those unwanted forces seeking to control us, hear this proclamation of the gospel. Jesus Christ is Lord and our addictions are not. Jesus Christ is Lord, and our anxiety, our fears are not. Jesus Christ is Lord, and our physical illnesses are not. Jesus Christ is Lord, and my social forces seeking to control me are not. Jesus Christ is Lord, and I am not. And so what happens next in the story shows that Jesus is Lord, and this evil spirit is not. When Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, you spirit that keeps this boy from speaking and hearing, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. After crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, "He is dead." But Jesus took him by the hand, lifted him up, and he was able to stand. Jesus was able to deliver that boy from the power of that unclean spirit. That's what Jesus the Lord looks like. He is someone who cares enough about children to respond to a father's request to help his little boy who is having seizures. And for us in this community, I know that there have been a lot of us praying for Matt and Maria Pucci and their newborn baby son, Icarus, who has been having seizures, was hospitalized, filled with tubes, and we've been praying for him. And I thank God for the reminder in our community that God still hears the prayers of a father caring for his boy with seizures. And last week, or earlier this week, Icarus came home, no tubes, and doing great. And so we can still believe that even today, Jesus is good, and Jesus is able, and Jesus is Lord. And so what do we do with this belief in Jesus as Lord? How do we put this into practice? We do it by breathing life into our faith through prayer. In the story, we see the loving way that Jesus heals not just the boy and his dad, but even his disciples at the end of this. It says, "When he had entered the house, his disciples asked him privately, 'Why could we not cast it out?' He said to them, 'This kind can only come out through prayer.'" Even though Jesus had previously given the disciples the power to heal the sick and to cast out spirits, the results of these gifts, the fruit of these gifts, was not theirs to control. And the fact that Jesus laments the faithlessness of that generation, and the fact that he tells them that this kind only comes out through prayer, indicates that whatever it was those disciples were doing, they weren't doing it in faith, and they weren't doing it in prayer. You see, the disciples, just like us today, they were given a great tool. They were given a gift of healing and deliverance, but their tool was not plugged in. The power to use our gift comes from God, and our connection to God comes through prayer. So here's how it works. Faith is recognizing that we are using gifts that aren't ours, that are powered by a source that isn't us. And when we pray, we can then be connected to God and see his power unleashed. And Jesus teaches the disciples that even the smallest amount of faith can move mountains. Faith can produce a massive amount of change, but the power to move mountains, we don't have the power to move mountains, but God does. Faith is believing that God's power is good and that his goodness is powerful. Who knows what great thing may be moved by even a small amount of faith that comes alive within you? For you, what mountains right now could you see being moved by even a small amount of faith? And the saying, you can move mountains, it may sound extreme, and I tend to avoid extreme language, but in this passage, Jesus is trying to inspire his disciples to see the scope of just how powerful God is and just how good God is. So we may be asking ourselves, is it unrealistic to think that with a little faith and with a little prayer that God can do the miraculous? Well, let's answer that with another question. Can God raise Jesus from the dead? Jesus Christ is raised from the dead, so in this life we have hope. But having faith also means that we choose to give up the right to control our situations, and we give up the right to tell God what we think he is supposed to do. We recognize that there may be other factors going on that we're not aware about, but that God does. And so if God does not choose to heal a particular person at a particular time, faith is the trust that God is still good and that God will still do what is best. And faith like that isn't easy. That can be difficult, and it can be painful. And we might not always get answers as to why a particular healing doesn't happen for a particular person at a particular time, but faith is this. It knows that at all times, for all people, God is there, and God is loving, and God is powerful, and God is good. Because we see the way that God makes all this work when we look at what God does at the cross. God's power is seen in his ability to bring about redemptive good, even in the midst of real suffering. When Jesus is on the cross, he shows the power of self-restraint and self-giving love. Because even though he suffered and even though he died, he was able to redeem the world so that the world could truly live. And in that moment, we also see the power of a father's love when God the Father raises his son from the dead so that this world could have life and that we could learn that this life right here is not all that there is. So does having faith include believing that God can do the miraculous? Yes. Does that mean that every single time we pray, we should expect miracles? Maybe. But the miracles are not up to us. They're not under our control. Our job is to pray. God's job is to decide what to do. And so we're going to pray for those who need to be made well, believing that God is able and that God is merciful. And so for you, maybe some of you connect with the story of Martin, the boy with the locked-in syndrome. Maybe for you, there's been some situation where you feel locked in under the control of unwanted forces. Maybe it's within your own body. Maybe it's your family. Maybe it's your past that's controlling you. Whatever it is, we can have hope that Jesus can deliver us. For Martin, his story ends well. He is still in a wheelchair, and he still is unable to use his vocal cords, but he has regained some of the use of his body, and he's able to wheel himself around, and he's able to use his computer to speak. Martin was able to get a job and even start his own computer business. One of the most heart-touching parts of his story is he said, when he was still trapped in his own body, unable to speak, he said, "I have love to give, but I don't think I'll ever be able to share it with anyone." But it turns out that wasn't true. And Martin was able to meet a woman through someone that he knew, and they fell in love. And she fell in love with his words, and they were able to get married, and he's able to share life with someone. And so if you want, you can go online and check out his TED Talk on YouTube, though if you do, I would suggest grabbing a big box of tissues. It's very moving. But for all of us, whatever forces are controlling us, hear the gospel right now. Jesus can set you free because Jesus is Lord and your past is not. Jesus is Lord and your body is not. Jesus is Lord and your social group is not. Jesus is Lord and your emotions are not. Jesus is Lord and the spiritual forces of this world are not. And so we can experience this freedom, this deliverance right now by faith and in prayer. So we're going to do that. We're going to pray and ask God to help us to see Jesus as he really is, and we're going to believe in the gospel that Jesus is Lord. So join me as we pray. Father, I thank you. I thank you for the gift of your Son, Christ. I thank you for the way that you have loved us. I thank you for the way that you deliver us. Lord, I thank you for the way that you have set us free. Because as you say in your word, whoever the Son has set free is free indeed. Deliver us now, Lord. Deliver us from all of those forces that have been controlling us that we don't want. The pressure of the people around us. The emotional distress that rages within us. Our failing, broken bodies that betray us with each passing year. from the realities of spiritual forces at work in this world that seek to do evil. Deliver us. Set us free. Lord, let us be captives no longer to the powers of this world, but set us free. And help us, God, help us to believe in you. Help us to believe that you can do this. Give us the faith to trust in you. For those here struggling with the junior high Jesus picture, God, give them an adult faith. Give them new eyes and a new heart to see you afresh, to see you, Jesus, as the face of love. Deliver us now. Heal us. Heal this broken world. Heal this hurting world. And we thank you as well, Lord, for the ways that you have already been doing this. Thank you for the prayers that you have answered in bringing Icarus home and the joy of seeing the way that you still care for kids. God, we thank you. We thank you that we have this hope. And we pray this, Jesus, in your name. Amen.